like to now call up our second witness. Welcome Eloise Cobell, a Blackfeet Indian from Montana and the lead plaintiff in the Cobell versus Norton litigation. She's accompanied today by Keith Harper of the Native American Rights Foundation and a member of her legal team in this litigation. Ms. Cobell, welcome back to the committee. Although I think we're all happy to see you today, I wish we weren't and that it was over with. But it is nice to have you come back. Thank you again for giving us your time to be here. Again, I remind you that your entire statement will be included in the record. If you could limit your oral testimony to 5 minutes, it will help us move along. So thank you, and when you're ready, you can begin.
Good morning, and thank you for those statements. Chairman Pombo and Ranking Member Ray Hall, distinguished members of this committee, first let me say how much I appreciate the work you and your staff have done on this important issue. I welcome your continued involvement and leadership. We join with you in the hopes that this will point the way toward a resolution of this thus far intractable problem. I know that I am not telling you anything new when I say that the mismanagement of individual Indian trusts has been one of the biggest injustices ever perpetrated by the representatives of our government. Study after study by Congress itself, the GAO, and many others, as well as now nearly 10 years of judicial findings and opinions in both district and appellate courts, confirmed that the injustice is pervasive, longstanding, and continuing, and that the financial loss to hundreds of thousands of Native Americans has been incredibly large. Let me read you just one statement. Secretary Norton has admitted and urged the court to adopt an undisputed facts in this statement. Indian trust data is wholly unreliable and utterly useless as an accurate measurement of anything except to confirm the manifest negligence and malfeasance inherent in Indian trust management. I would like to just read that one more time. Indian trust data is wholly unreliable and utterly useless as an accurate measurement of anything except to confirm the manifest negligence and malfeasance inherent in Indian trust management. And for the record, I have submitted a list of just some of these studies and reports that confirm the magnitude of this problem. I hope you agree with me that this is the time for study and reflection is well in the past. It is time to do something. You are well acquainted with this injustice, and we applaud you for moving to try to do something constructive about it. I hope you share my frustration that the United States government has not been similarly constructive. In thinking about how to settle this case, we must bear in mind certain salient considerations. First, it is the government that has caused this problem. In a fit of paternalism, they imposed this trust on us. They mismanaged our assets. They lost billions of dollars. Our only role was to suffer the consequences of their mistakes. The Cobell case is about saying, no longer will we tolerate this abuse. Second, we must always bear in mind that this is our money and this is our land. This is not a federal handout. This is not a federal program. We are asking for a full accounting of our money and restitution of any of it that is missing. Over 500,000 Indians have had their assets mismanaged. In the total amount of financial loss and the total number of victims, this scandal dwarfs all of the corporate misdeeds we've heard so much about, Enron and WorldCom and others, are petty crimes in comparison. Third, settlement is entirely possible. There is an impediment to settlement: the Departments of Justice and Interior. We have participated in complete good faith. They have not. Consider this. This committee and the Senate Indian Affairs Committee early in 2005 requested that Indian Country work together to develop a comprehensive plan to resolve this case. We did exactly that. In a united effort, we worked closely with leaders throughout Indian Country. The product was a detailed set of 50 principles, specific explanations for why each is important. Then Senators McCain and Dorgan introduced their settlement bill. We continue to work in good faith. We provide specifics on what we liked and what we needed to be revised. We have engaged the Senate and presented detailed comments on its draft. We are regularly met with the staff. We have come forward with proposed settlement numbers. The government's response to your efforts stands in stark contrast. Oh, they certainly pay lip service to cooperating, but what proposals have they put on the table? They have never said, not once, what they believe specific terms and their acceptable settlement amounts. They have refused to take a position on the bill. Members of the committee, if you wish to exert leadership, you must call the government to account. Do not allow their foot dragging to continue. Call them to task. Demand that they participate in legislative process. Demand that they inform you of the specific contours of a settlement they will support. If there is hope for a legislative settlement, they must no longer be allowed to simply sit back and say no to all settlement offers without members of this committee denouncing their objections. If not, a legislative settlement will never occur. Use your influence to raise the profile of this issue, to call their continued delays what they are, a continuing slap in the face to Indians and to innate sense of justice of all Americans. That magnifies the underlying wrongdoing. By failing to acknowledge the problems and refusing to work to resolve it, government officials continue the more than century-old tradition of kicking the problem to the future as victims die off. Meanwhile, beneficiaries who have been mistreated their entire lives do not see a resolution as even possible in their lifetime. Many have given up hope after so many false starts. As you proceed, I cannot, in good conscience, fail to remind you that the government's behavior in this matter has gone well beyond delay and obstruction. It includes a sad history of misrepresentation and deceit. That sorry record includes a glossy progress report put out this summer that is deceptive, misleading, and inaccurate from beginning to end. Sworn testimony before the courts and Congress, and more recently, a complete misrepresentation of the Cabal 17 decision. After 10 years of litigation, we have been forced to the sad conclusion that the word of the government officials is not trusted. The government has seized on some language in Cabal 17 that is not relevant to the issue at hand, and more importantly, not controlling in this case. They will not tell you about something called the first-in-time rule. This rule, a very basic rule in the D.C. Circuit and virtually all other circuits, says that when there is discrepancy between the language of appellate panels, the first-in-time controls. The rule makes clear that Cabal 6, Cabal 12, and Cabal 13 remain the controlling law in this case, and that the words that the government has so foundly seized upon and that we heard so much from Mr. Kasten are not important. This is a legal matter I have covered more thoroughly in my written testimony. More importantly, it would be a serious mistake for members of this committee or anyone else to be persuaded by government officials who have been repeatedly cited by the courts for misrepresenting judicial decisions. that anything in Cabell 17 lessens by one penny the government's huge liability in this case. I want to talk about H.R. 4322 as a starting point. We are encouraged that you have said that H.R. 4322 is a starting point and a placeholder, and that dialogue, discussion, and negotiations are encouraged. I hope we will be able to begin a constructive dialogue with this committee, similar to the one we have engaged with Senator McCain and Senator Dorgan. I believe there are some critical shortcomings to the bill as presently drafted. There are two sources of guidance that should inform any appropriate legislative settlement. First, the 50 principles for settlement, which present a consensus roadmap to resolution from Indian country. Second, the decision that the courts have issued in Cabell litigation over the past 9.5 years, which must be honored. We believe the bill should better reflect the ideas and legal concepts encapsulated in these two sources. We appreciate that you are actively soliciting our input on the bill. With that in mind, we offer a number of additional specific comments on the bill in our written testimony. I would like to highlight three of the most important. The Treasury Department should not be in charge of the settlement funds. It is one of the historic wrongdoers in the case, and putting it in charge of the settlement is like letting the fox guard the hen house. Treasury is not only a defendant, but has also been held in contempt of court for violating court orders. Moreover, it has routinely and intentionally destroyed trust records to hide its malfeasance. In one document instance, the Treasury Department destroyed 162 boxes, untold millions of pages of irreplaceable data. Simply put, it cannot be trusted any longer and should not be involved in any way with the distribution of funds. The courts have the greatest institutional competence to make distributions in a fair manner and are appropriate institution to do so. Importantly, the Indian Land Working Group, the largest national association of lawtee groups, has specifically said that they do not want Treasury involved. As we do, they have endorsed the federal courts as the appropriate body to handle any distribution. The Cabell case is far more than the past mismanagement. It is also about the trust lands and monies of Indian people and how it will be managed in the future. Quite obviously, a settlement of this case requires the persistent and continuing wrongdoing, in other words, a real trust reform. My written submission has detailed what we believe it must include. The settlement of Native American leaders proposed is a good deal, especially for taxpayers. The proposed amount of $27.5 billion, a large number, but large crimes incur large consequences. Moreover, it is a bargain for a government that has acknowledged its responsibility for a 118-year-old mess. First, it would resolve a dispute that members of Congress have said has run too long and cost too much. It is estimated that the government alone has spent more than $100 million on this lawsuit. Those expenses grow every single day. The government's liability is growing. The courts have declared that Indian trust beneficiaries are entitled to both the principal amounts that should have been recorded in their accounts plus compounded interest. A fundamental principle of trust law confirmed by the Court of Appeals is that the government is liable for any funds that it cannot prove with appropriate and competent evidence that it paid to the beneficiaries. Since both sides agree that the government should have paid roughly $13 billion into the individual Indian trust since 1887, that means that the government must be able to prove each of those transactions. Any amount not proven to have been paid plus interest is what is owed. This puts potential liability of the federal government well in the excess of $100 billion. The historical accounting will continue to be costly. The Interior Department is now telling you that it will cost at least $12 billion to try to reconstruct those records. That far is too expensive for an accounting. We, well before the Court of Appeals reached that conclusion, we were saying that in court. A 2002 study conducted by Interior Department and made public in our lawsuit places the liability for the government on trust accounts at anywhere between $10 billion and $40 billion. This is the government's own experts. That's why Indians Country 27.5 billion proposal is a bargain. I would argue that it is far better for the taxpayers to be spending this money directly on giving Indian account holders what is rightfully theirs than wasting money on what we and the courts regard as a highly questionable accounting and delaying exercise. We have put out a settlement number in good faith for all to see. We encourage the government and the Congress to do the same. On a final note, the Court of Appeals recently remanded the case of the District Court as we had requested. The Court made clear that the District Court was well within its authority to hold a trial on whether it is impossible for the government to perform an accounting required by law. We will now proceed to ask for an evidentiary hearing on the impossibility of doing an accounting. We believe that this will lead to a more expedited resolution than we had previously expected. Make no mistake about it. We think a settlement will be good for everyone. But if this process of looking for a just settlement fails, we will continue the litigation and we will expect to win and prevail. Any statement to the contrary by the government are nothing more than wishful thinking. Finally, I would like to say that I don't just speak for myself. I speak for a class of 500,000 victims of this travesty. The largest Allotte group, the Indian Land Working Group, specifically endorses the decisions I have made and the trust, my judgment, and that of my team. I have attached the Indian Land Working Group's recent resolution of support to the written submission, and I ask that it be made part of the record. I also ask that my total written statement be made part of the record at this time. I would like to thank you very much for your leadership on this important issue, and we look forward to working with you in the coming weeks. Thank you.